Welcome back to the Victory Degree Podcast. Today, we have someone that you may have heard of. He is a basketball skills trainer, and his clients include some NBA players that you also may have heard of. Joel Embiid, Tyrese Maxey, Bradley Beal. Any of those names ring a bell? If they do, then I'm excited to welcome our guest, Drew Hanlon. Drew, welcome.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to join you. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, I hope so. I'll start with this because there's a couple different topics I want to touch on. So there's obviously how Drew Hanlon came to be, which includes your childhood, which includes some of the things that you were doing early on, includes a college career in basketball. And then it also includes a transition to the skills trainer life that you have now. And then another topic is you have a new book coming out. You're now, you know, you consider yourself an entrepreneur, you're an author, so you got a lot of things going on. So those are kind of the different topics that I want to touch on. But I figured we'd start with kind of early on Drew and who that person was and why you have to stop at every lemonade stand that you see.
So first off, I'm going to say this. The young Drew is loving the retro jerseys you have in the background right now.
Because yeah.
Those were the best NBA jerseys, in my opinion. But that's really where it takes me. You know, the young Drew was a basketball lover, was somebody that would not miss a Michael Jordan basketball game. I remember there was one time where, you know, I don't know what I got in trouble for, but I got in trouble for something and I got grounded from watching the Michael Jordan game on TV. And I went in and I stole my dad's Walkman radio. You know, that's dating me. I'm 35, but I stole my dad's Walkman and I was in my room listening to the Walkman, put it up to my like pillow so they couldn't see. And I remember my dad hearing it and came in and like took the Walkman from me. I'm like, man, like now I don't even get to pay attention. But that's who I was as a youngster. And, you know, I was one of those guys that, you know, I grew up in a middle class family where, you know, we didn't necessarily have the best of everything. But what we did have was my parents were willing to help us work for whatever we wanted. And so, you know, that meant, you know, if I wanted new shoes, it meant, you know, running a lemonade stand, and it meant cutting grass. It meant shoveling snow. It meant dog sitting. It meant doing whatever you possibly could to make a few extra bucks to get whatever you wanted. And, you know, so I remember when I first started my first lemonade stand, I lived on one busy street, but one not as busy cross street. And so I would do my lemonade stand there. But then I realized one day after doing a lemonade stand at two busy cross streets right up the street that I made more money. And so I started, you know, sitting out on that corner and would make as much money as I needed to for that day and then go out and do whatever I, you know, wanted to do. But, you know, so now my golden rule is it doesn't matter how busy I am. I never pass up a lemonade stand just because I always like to tell the kids that I'm buying the lemonade stand, and I always like tip them $20 and they like go crazy. Like I love driving off and they're like high fiving each other. But I always do. I'm like, hey guys, I love this mentality of like work to get what you want, because that's going to take you farther than anybody handing you, you know, free handouts will. And so, yeah, I love the lemonade story. It's just a representation of everything I believe in and everything that I've done to you know, achieve anything that I've been after, whether that was playing career, training career, or now the other, you know, entrepreneurial endeavors that I'm doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, moving your lemonade stand to a busier street, you figured out supply and demand pretty quickly.
I know. I was a very smart, savvy, you know, 7-year-old, I think, back then. So, no, but I mean, it is good. I think it's funny how, you know, a lot of times you see the older generations always complain about the younger generations. And, you know, I never want to be one of those people that like says, oh, I walked to school or I did this. But like, I do think that our youth has went away from, you know, challenging each other to pick up games in driveways, and they don't meet up at fields to play wiffle ball anymore. They don't, you know, play, you know, touch football, or they don't do the lemonade stands, you know. And so it's one of those things where whenever I do see somebody kind of going the old fashioned route of, you know, hustling and bustling, I always appreciate it and always try to show them love.
Yeah, and it's almost this culture of instant gratification. And I mean, I've talked about it plenty on this podcast, where it's everything is expected to happen overnight, whether you're building a podcast, whether you're, you know, trying to build an MBA career. It's like this idea that, well, if I just post, you know, a couple clips of me dunking on social media, you know, that's it. Like I'm gonna get, you know, recruited by Duke or North Carolina or whatever. And it's like, that's not really how it works. And so this whole like culture of instant gratification has seeped into so many different aspects of the life that we live that it's honestly pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And again, I'm big on consistency over intensity. And I think if you can do both, that's great. But I think the majority of people, they have these intense moments of motivation where they say they're going to go all in and they're going to do these amazing things. But the things that they're saying they're going to do are so different from their current actions that once they start them, you know, then they stop them right away. They don't continuously do them long enough for them to actually pay off. You know, I literally posted something on my Instagram yesterday, a little section for my book, and it was basically a perfect representation of that. I'm going to read it for you just because I think it hits home. You know, I literally just posted on a story, but is most people aim for dramatic overnight change, but real lasting transformation doesn't come from intensity. It comes from consistency. One salad won't make you healthy, just like one pizza won't make you unhealthy. It's repeated choices day after day that shape your outcome. And I think that's the biggest thing is people need to shift their mindset from what is the most audacious, biggest task that I can do today to what is a task that I can consistently do even on the days that I don't feel great, even on the moments that I don't feel awesome, even on, you know, the days where I'm busy. And if you can commit to that change and get in the habit of doing, you know, certain things that ultimately build up to big things, I think that's when you start really winning in life.
I'm curious what your opinion is on, because I've heard other people talk about consistency and we'll get, I want to ask you a follow-up question on how consistency and intensity was, you applied to your own life, because there's some examples from sixth grade and high school, but we'll get to that. I've heard a lot of people talk about, like, for example, the gym, right? And you know, it's the New Year's resolution time. And I think this Friday, if I'm not mistaken, tomorrow is the day that most people quit, or maybe it's next Friday that most people quit on their New Year's resolution. And so, like, the advice that I've heard for the gym is, like, if you make the gym out to be this huge, scary thing, and if you think that every time you go to the gym, you need to spend an hour and a half and you need to do all these workouts, you're never going to go. Like, that friction is now so high that it's just this huge, terrible monster that you're never going to conquer. Versus if you say, like, all right, you know what? Maybe let's not do the hour and a half workout. Let me go for 15 minutes or even 20 minutes. Let me just get myself to, let's first get myself to the gym. Let me drive to the gym. Like, that is an accomplishment in and itself. And then we can worry about, like, are we doing cardio? Are we doing chest? Are we doing, you know, biceps, whatever? What's your opinion on that?
I know, I'm 100% with you. You know, there was a calendar year where I helped my dad lose 90 pounds and he was extremely unhealthy. And the first thing I had to do was I had to help connect with him instead of try to convince him. I had to connect with him. I you know, instead of being able to say, hey, Pops, you need a six pack, which never resonated with him. He didn't care. He was married. He had kids and grandkids. He was like, I don't need to, you know, look great in front of the mirror. I'm happy with the life I have. But what I needed to do was I need to connect with him on a deeper level. And so the first thing I think everyone needs to do is connect. And what that meant for him was I had to have a conversation with him and say, hey, Dad, you lost your dad about 10 years before you should have because of his unhealthy choices. You know, if he would have made different decisions, if he would have taken different actions, if he would have ate healthier and worked out more and you know, laid off, you know, some of the hardcore drinking that he did at night when he was having aches and pains from working so hard to put himself to sleep, we would have probably got an extra decade with my grandpa, your dad. You know, think about every single birthday that you have to go to his gravesite and, you know, you have to, you know, sit there and talk to his grave instead of talking to him. You know, think about every morning where you used to wake up and give them a hug because they worked together, and now you don't get that morning hug. Think about your mom, my grandma, who now has lived over a decade without her soulmate, all because of his decisions and actions. Well, guess what, Pops? If you keep going down this road, you're going to have to, you know, have us live with those same regrets and pains that you have to live with now. You know, mom is going to be just like your mom, and she's going to be, you know, the one that has to live without her soulmate for a decade. We're going to have to go to your graveside instead of being able to celebrate great moments with you. And so when I did that, the next morning, he started walking for the first time in his life. And it wasn't a hard thing. I said, hey, Pops, guess what I challenge you to do? I challenge you to lay out your clothes tomorrow right in front of your door. You know why? Because you're going to feel really bad walking over those clothes and letting me down and letting yourself down and letting all the kids down and letting your wife down. So just lay out the clothes. And if something in you says walk over those clothes, that means we haven't connected enough with your heart. But what happened is he actually put those clothes on. He walked out the door. Now, I didn't tell him to go run a marathon. I said, walk. He said, how long? I said, I don't care. Walk around the block. If you're feeling great, walk around the neighborhood. Just walk. And then the next day, lay out your clothes again and walk again. And what happened is over time, it went from walking around the block to walking around the neighborhood to, you know, then it was walking 5 miles a day in an hour. And then it became, let's see how fast I can walk 5 miles. And slowly you just saw that weight trimming down. And I remember everybody being like, wow, Brady, what workout program are you doing? He's like, I'm not even lifting weights. I'm just walking every single day. And then we started adding little things where we'd say, hey, listen, every time you get, you know, get your meal, just cut it in half, eat half of it, and then wait 15 minutes. And if you're still hungry, you can eat the other half. But what he realized was his portion control was bad. He was just eating whatever was in front of him. And so then he realized, oh man, I don't need all the food that I'm consuming. And so that's what it means to me, is it means that, you know, how do you find the smallest detail, what I call starter steps, things that get you going, that build momentum. And then once you have that momentum, then you become that person. And so my dad went from being somebody that did not care about, you know, his health and exercising and nutrition to I'm somebody that loves my family enough to do those things. And so I think that's what more people need to do, is that we really need to connect with those things that will drive action. And then they have to make those actions small enough so they can do them consistently over time so they can build up to big results.
That's a great example. And it reminds me of something that James Clear talks about in Atomic Habits, where he says, stop viewing yourself as someone. So like, for example, like if you want to become a reader, stop viewing yourself as someone who reads, but instead view yourself as a reader. Or stop viewing yourself as somebody who goes to the gym. View yourself as someone who is athletic or who is active. And it's, to your point, it's those small things, right? Those little shifts in your mentality that can create this entire new persona. And it's really powerful. Like, I encourage everyone to go and try it. Like what Drew just talked about, whether it's small steps that could build into huge habits, or if it's little, you know, shifts in your mentality on how you view yourself. I mean, the impact can be, I mean, incredible.
And that's what it is. Like, you know, you talked a little bit about some of the work habit things you wanted to touch on, but like every morning when I was in high school, I used to shoot 1,000 shots a day every morning. And, you know, I missed 4 days in 4 years, which is pretty damn impressive. And I remember 3 of those days, I couldn't even do anything. It was like snow days where it was too icy. I couldn't get anybody to open up the gym. And then one day I was sick, like to the point where I remember I was like throwing up and I was like, I'm going to the gym still. And they're like, you're not. Like, you have to be smart. But when you add those up, if you do 1,000 and multiply that by 365 days times 4 years, you even got the leap year included in there, and you're going, Drew shot almost 1.5 million shots before most of his classmates and most of the people that he was competing with for the same scholarships even woke up every morning. That was 1.5 million shots up on them. So then when it came recruiting time, you know, obviously, you know, there were some people that were just as good as me, but hadn't done the things that I had did. And I got that advantage over them. And that was some of the reasons why that I was able to get, you know, a bunch of college scholarships and then end up playing college basketball, which was one of my dreams. But, you know, it wasn't like I was born with 1.5 million shot advantage. I was born with a hard work ethic, and I put in the work and I poured into my craft. And that's what gave me that advantage. And so I really do think too many people point fingers at, you know, their circumstances, their genetics, you know, all the other things that they want to blame, the environment, the world itself. There's so many things you can point your fingers at, but those don't help you. What you got to do is you got to start looking at what do you have and make the best of those resources, because I really do believe, you know, that every hand has a chance to be a winner if you play it the right way.
Speaking of, you know, we spoke about intensity and consistency at the beginning of this podcast. I would argue that putting up 1,000 shots every single day in high school is both intense and consistent. You know, high school days, you know, I was probably playing Call of Duty, as I'm sure a lot of your classmates were. And Drew was in the gym putting up 1,000 shots a day. So what was your why? Because I always stumble back on that, because I'm sure there was plenty of mornings or plenty of days where you got up and you're like, the last thing I want to go do right now is put up 1,000 shots at this gym. And I found that, like, a lot of times, whether it's this podcast or anything else I do in life, if something's difficult, I always try to fall back on a why. Like, why am I doing this? What's the end goal? What's the vision? So I'm curious as to what your why was for putting up 1,000 shots a day.
Listen, I just love basketball. And I know that if I'm going to play something, if I'm going to do anything, I want to be great at it. Like, I do not know how people love things that they're not good at. Like, I could never love something I'm not good at. Like, when I first started playing golf, like, I was like, I hate this. I suck at it. you know? And so then I became obsessed with it and got better and better. And then I became a single digit handicap in 3 years. And everyone's like, there's no way you just started playing golf. I was like, y'all don't understand. If I'm going to do something, I'm going to go all in. I'm going to try everything I can to get good at that thing. And so for me, it was like, hey, Drew, if you're going to play basketball, why not pour into basketball and be the best player you can possibly be? Because that's where you reap all the rewards. You know what I mean? Like I always say this to people. I'm like, if you're going to show up to practice, you might as well use that 2 hours and get as good as you can during that 2 hours. I don't understand people that just coast through workouts. Like, I don't understand people that have New Year's resolutions. They show up to the gym and then they slack off in the gym. I'm like, you realize you're only hurting yourself. Then I also don't realize that, like, people that plays, like, let's say on a team, let's say basketball, I'm like, is it more fun to be the star of the team or to be coming off the bench? Is it more fun to be opening up a newspaper, reading about yourself or your teammates or your opponents? Is it more fun to get college scholarships or being the one that wishes that you had opportunities for college coaches to look at you and see you? I'm like, obviously, it's easy which one you choose, but I really do think that most people don't look at it as, like, choose your hard. Hard to wake up in the morning, hard to shoot 1,000 shots, or hard to swallow the pill that you're not very good and you're not going to go play college sports and you're going to have $120,000 of debt that you didn't get from your college scholarships because you didn't do these things. And I'm like, you know, that was one of the things that my parents always said to us. We were like, we didn't have college funds. And so they were like, if you want to go to college, you either have to take out a loan, get an athletic scholarship, or get an academic scholarship. Those are your choices. And I chose athletic scholarship, and I poured everything that I could into that to make sure that that happened.
I want to bookmark golf because I need to ask you about your golf session with MJ, but we'll do that maybe towards the end. So I'll bookmark that for us. When you're in high school, you clearly had a passion, as you just laid out, you had a passion to play basketball and play at the college level. But you also had this, like, entrepreneurial side of you that showed up with the lemonade stand and maybe showed up in other aspects throughout your high school career. What was there ever, like, a crossroads for you where you were like, all right, I'm either going to do this college basketball thing or I'm either going to go to school, maybe study business or try my hand at starting a company early on? Was that ever a decision for you?
No, I mean, it wasn't. You know, I have so many college athletes now reach out to me and say, how did you do it? Like, we struggle with just getting good enough grades to stay eligible and play basketball. How did you do that plus running a business? You know, I started training NBA players when I was in college. I was training Brad Beal, who developed into an NBA player when I was, in high school. And they're like, how did you do that? And to me, it was all about prioritizing my time. You know, one of the things I love doing when I'm doing corporate speaking on stage is I say, everybody take out your phones, and everybody grabs their phone and I go to your battery, click on your usage and look at it. And you just hear a blanket of like everybody grasps at the same time because they realize they're spending 3 hours a day on Instagram. They're spending, an hour a day, doing this and that and this and that. And you build it up and you're going, you waste 7 hours a day on something. Whether that's video games, whether that's watching TV, whether that's social media, whether that's, whatever it is, we all have our own little things to escape. But most people waste 7 hours a day is about a good average. Then you have your work and then you have the things you have to do. And it's like there's not much time to actually do the things you want to do. And so I've always just been better at prioritizing my time. You know, people would say, I don't have time to shoot 1,000 shots. Well, that's why I woke up at 4:59 a.m. Well, then I'm not going to get enough sleep. I need 8 hours of sleep. Well, just go to sleep earlier because what do you do at night that's really productive? I don't see you doing anything productive at midnight. You know what I mean? So that's what I would say is I never thought I had to do one or the other. I just thought I have to be very strategic with my free time so that I'm best utilizing it for things that benefit me instead of things that don't.
You mentioned Brad Beal, and we'll obviously get to your clients and your experience with basketball skills training, because there's a whole plethora of topics within that. But I'm curious, like, because Beal was one of your first clients, and so
my first,
your very first client was Bradley Beal. Not too shabby. Not too shabby. We'll see what happens with the Suns, and I mean, there's always rumors with that, but. Were you confident when you first started training with Bradley Beal? Were you confident in your own ability as a skills trainer?
I had no idea that I was going to be a skills trainer. So the part of the story that never gets told was Brad was working out with me. Believe it or not, I was better than Brad. I was the player of the year in Missouri. So, you know, eighth grade year, we played against him and, you know, I destroyed his team. And after the game, his parents asked me to work him out. Hey, Drew, you're going to a mid-major. You know, we would love for our son to go to a mid-major as well. He's undersized like you. At the time, he was probably my height. And, you know, we were both 5'11". And they were like, you know, we'd really love for him to work out with you. So Brad worked out with me. He hated it. I literally kicked his ass. He hated it. Didn't show up the rest of summer. Then he has a freshman year. He averages 8 points a game, which is good. You know, 8 points a game as a freshman on varsity. And after that year, we won the state championship. My team did. And, you know, I was getting ready to go off to college. And his parents were like, hey, we don't care what, if Brad likes it or not. We want him to work out with you again. That whole summer, we worked out together. Like, we'd work out together. He'd just follow the leader, basically. He did what I did. And then, you know, afterwards, we'd play one-on-one. And, you know, at the time, again, I'm the one winning the one-on-one games. And the second game of his sophomore season, he scored over 50 points. And I think he had 51 or 52 points. And everybody was like, what did you do all summer? And he had grown a couple inches. He had already had a great foundation that, you know, his mom had taught him how to shoot at early age. His dad had poured into him. His brothers had, you know, really lifted weights hard with him. They were all football, college football players. So it was like the perfect storm, but I was the new addition to the puzzle. And that's when I was like, wait, what's working for me, that hard work, is also working for him. Why don't I start applying this to other people? And so I started to apply it to a ton of players around St. Louis area. You know, a bunch of people started getting results. Some of them got college scholarships. Some of them just went from, you know, being on the freshman team to varsity team, et cetera. And then I was like, wow, what I've learned is, you know, there's, if you pay attention to the details and you put in enough hard work, you're going to get results. And so then I started really studying the game so that I could actually know what I was doing so I could add that smart work. You know, at that time, we were working hard and we were working consistently, but we weren't working smart. We were just working really, really hard. And then I started really studying my ass off, breaking down film, going to conferences, picking coaches' brains, you know, basically having conversations with anybody that would have a conversation with me. And I started just writing down everything. And, you know, I remember in college, I had a 2,400-page notebook that I had of just straight notes. And I started typing it all up. And I still have container after container full of handwritten notes. And that's what I had to do to you know, shrink the knowledge gap, because the work ethic was there. You know, I was going to put in the work. I was going to help. The motivation factor was there. I knew how to get people to pour into themselves as well. I just didn't know what I was doing on the court. And so that's the missing piece that had to, you know, catch up quickly, because I had so many people trusting me with their game. And over time, I just, you know, improved my craft. I constantly asked for feedback from these players. And you know, really, I've always been a results-driven person. If something was working, I kept trying to make it work even better. If something wasn't working, I'd quickly pivot to things that did work. And, you know, it's a trial and error kind of game where you try enough stuff, you learn what works and what doesn't. And, you know, that's what I've been fortunate to do throughout my entire career.
Was there, because I'm assuming that not every client that you worked with when you started out, especially in the St. Louis area, did not pan out to have the type of career that Bradley Beal did.
No.
So there was clearly something different about Brad that differentiated him from the rest of, let's say, the group of clients that you had, whether that's, you know, athleticism, skill, right, personal drive, whatever. I'm curious what that is, because I'm assuming, again, that the program that you had was probably pretty similar across your client base, but very different results.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, I think everyone saw a jump in their game. And what I tell Brad, and Brad and I laugh about this all the time, I always go like this. I go one level, maybe two. And what that means is, like, I can help somebody get to a level or two levels that they maybe can't get to themselves. But I can't take them from way down here to way up here. You know what I mean? So, like, for me, example, I worked just as hard, if not harder, than Brad. I worked just as hard, if not harder, than Jason. I did all the things they did plus, and I still didn't make it. Now, that could have been talent. That could have been height. That could have been athleticism. That could have been a lot of factors. But I feel like I maximized my career to a very good place for what I was capable of doing. Now, saying that, I look back and I always say, man, I wish I would have had me for me, because I think that I gave up the dream of playing NBA too early because I was too realistic. I was like, ah, you know what? 5'11 white American, probably not getting drafted, you know, average athlete, you know, whatever. I made excuses and they seem justifiable because if you look, you know, the last time a sub 6 foot white American was drafted, I think was like 1990 or something like that. So you're going, in my lifetime, there's only been like one or maybe zero guys that have ever been drafted. It's just not probable. But then you look at the outliers, the guys like, you know, in the book, I actually outline a story about Isaiah Thomas. And, you know, we were the same age and he's 5'8". And I remember as a freshman, he was probably, I don't know, 5'3", 5'4", 5'5", telling everybody he was going to make the NBA. He had some kind of, you know, unbreakable faith that I didn't have, you know, a mindset that I didn't have. And so I think that that's what I really learned was, you know, my job was to help them on the court improve as much as they could. Then also try to tap into, you know, motivation and mindset levels that they couldn't tap to on their own. And then again, try to help them get to a level or two levels beyond what they could take themselves to. And I think that that's what, you know, my job is always. You know, if I see a kid at a park shooting, it's not like I'm going to say, oh, man, I'm going to go work him out one time and now I'm going to give him the secret sauce to be an NBA player. What I'm saying is I'm going to go help him try to do one thing to help turn something on in his mind, one thing to try to turn on something in his heart, and then teach him something tactically or some kind of skill on the court that's going to improve his game. And then over time, if he continues to do these things, it'll lead to great results. And so, you know, that's what I would say is I don't think that everybody I can turn, you know, I can't turn, you know, water into wine. You know what I mean? I can't turn, you know, everybody into an NBA superstar. But what I do think is I think I can raise everybody's game a level or two beyond what they can take themselves to.
So you're saying you can't turn me into Jokic, which is fine because he's one of one. He's also better than Embiid. We'll get into that later. I have to ask because it's top of mind and we're actually having him on the podcast tomorrow. Jonathan Abrams wrote a fantastic book, Boys Among Men, which highlights basically the journey of high school players to the NBA. Obviously now that's, you know, it's been outlawed, but you know, you had your Kevin Garnett's, your Kobe Bryant's, your Tyson Chandler's, Amari Stoudemire's was actually from Orlando. Didn't know that. Tracy McGrady, also from the Orlando area. And you're a high school player coming out and, you know, you went to college, you didn't go straight to the NBA. You've worked with high school players. Do you think we need to bring back the ability for high school players to go straight to the NBA? Or do you think that it is a good thing that they need to stay in college for at least a year?
Listen, I think there's always exceptions to the rules. You look at guys like LeBron, you look at the guys like Dwight Howard, you look at, you know, the guys like KG and those and Kobe's. Those guys all panned out and you wouldn't want to change their careers for anything. Saying that, I think that there's also a lot of cases of the opposite where players made the jump and weren't as successful as anyone thought they were going to be. And so, you know, my opinion is I do think that there's a freedom of choice where I think that everybody, you know, should be able to do kind of what they want. But I think the reason the NBA put it in place was to protect, you know, the people from falling without a safety net, you know, for those guys to get one extra year of maturity. I think it also was put in because I think teams want an extra year to evaluate them. It is so hard to evaluate high school players because you never know what their competition level is. Whereas once you get to the Division I level, at least it pans out a little bit. They're competing against, you know, a lot of other great players. And so I think it was a protection mechanism for teams to also not, you know, take risk on these high risk, high reward players. If I was the GM or if I was the, you know, commissioner, if I was Adam Silver, I would say there probably had to be some kind of rule in place where, you know, high school athletes might be able to put their name into the draft. But if they weren't selected in the top in the lottery or the first round or whatever it is, then they're still eligible to go back to college. You know, so there is a fallback plan so they don't just fall flat on their face. But I think it also is hard just because you see, I mean, even Reed Sheppard, who's a great player, he just got moved down to the G League after being selected, I think, third in the draft this year. And, I mean, he scored like close to 50 points. I think he had 49 or 48 or 47 points in his G League debut. That shows you how good players are. You know, he's that good, and he's still not finding, you know, his way into a consistent spot in the Houston Rockets rotation. So, again, I know that's a long-winded answer to say, I think there are exceptions where, you know, a Wembanyama, a LeBron, a Kobe, a Tracy McGrady, you know, those kind of players, yes, it makes sense for them to just jump in and start developing the NBA and pouring, you know, 100% of their time into basketball. But I do think that there's a lot of instances where, you know, guys made the jump too soon, and you know, there's probably a lot of, there would be a lot more instances of people jumping too soon and not making it. So I think that, you know, the protection's there just to try to help out both the teams and the players from ultimately making bad decisions.
It's a good take. And I have to say, it's a really good book too. I highly recommend it. Again, Boys Among Men. We'll have Jonathan on the podcast tomorrow, but it's cool because he brings up a lot of examples of obviously the people who made it, but then also you have, you know, the Eddie Currys of the world who, you know, he was dubbed as the next Shaq coming out of high school, and then, you know, completely flopped and not have anywhere close to a career of what was expected. And it kind of highlights maybe the reasons why there was another guy, Corleone Young, who got drafted by the Pistons. And I'm always, honestly, one of the more surprising things that I kind of knew, but not to the extent that the book brings out, is the impact of the organization that you're going to. And I've talked about it on this podcast with NFL quarterbacks because it seems especially important for them if you go into a good system with a good coach, with a good offense that caters to your strengths. I'm curious, though, from your experience with the clients that you've worked with and the organizations that you've seen around the league, the importance of where you get drafted and what organization you go into and how the organization is set up and how much the organization supports you and like all of these things that like we as fans don't necessarily maybe see or read about, but perhaps are very important to the development of a young player. Just your take on what you've seen.
I mean, it's huge. Not only the organization, but also the decisions that the front office makes, also the coaching. You know, I think that there's so many things that go into the success of an athlete, you know, on and off the field. And so, you know, I'll give you a quick example, which, you know, because I have both sides of the fence, but you know, the Celtics, for instance, you know, they draft Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, and, you know, they win a championship last year, whereas the Sixers had, you know, the number one pick in both of those drafts. Imagine what Embiid, you know, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum would have been like, you know, if they were all combined. Well, people criticize Joel for this or that, and rightfully so, everybody has their own opinions on certain players, but, you know, you could easily say, well, if the GMs at the time made different decisions on drafting different players, think about how his career could have been different. You know, then you think about, you know, you brought up the Denver Nuggets, you know, they won a championship, but then they also let some key players go. And so then they haven't been able to get back to that, you know, same kind of team that they had when they did go on that run and win. Well, does that mean that Jokic is a worse player because he's not able to get it? No, it just means he doesn't have the same help. You know, you look at Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan did not win a championship until he got Phil Jackson and he got Scottie Pippen. You know, you look at Kevin Garnett. Kevin Garnett made it past the first round one time in his Minnesota days. Then he jumped ship. He went to the Boston Celtics. He wins a championship and he's looked at as a champion. You know, and so I think there's so many different examples of players that if you say, if you put them in a different environment, a different role, a different, you know, team, a different coach, you would see something completely different. You know, there was a study done a while back that was talking about the NBA's most improved player. And they looked at it and they said, well, the majority of the time that a player won most improved, either a coach changed, there was a big trade that was involved, whether either they lost a star player or they moved teams. And there was one other thing. But it was really like, so did all those most improved players really improve, or did their opportunity improve? Did their coaching improve? Did, you know what I mean? So I think that those are the things that fans just don't get, don't understand, you know, and that's why for me, when I'm judging players, I try to look at the eye test. I try to see, what do I look at on the court? You know, you see a lot of players that were in the Michael Jordan era that didn't win a championship. And, you know, the guys that did win a championship, Hakeem, won when Michael Jordan wasn't playing, you know. And so if Michael Jordan plays those 2 years and doesn't go to baseball, what does Hakeem look like? You know, let's look at LeBron's career, who's, in my opinion, the second greatest basketball player ever. What if Kyrie Irving doesn't make that shot? What if if Ray Allen doesn't make that shot? Now he's got two championships. Now what is he looked at like? Well, guess what? He didn't shoot those shots. He didn't get the offensive rebound to kick it out. But yet that is defining in our era of sports. That's defining his legacy. You know, there was also, on the flip side of it, There were multiple times where he was in the finals and he led both teams in points, rebounds, assists, you know, everything basically, and they didn't win. Well, that wasn't because of him necessarily. That was because you didn't have the teammates. So it could have been both sides of the thing. You know, what if Kevin Durant doesn't, his foot isn't on the line? You know, then the Bucks don't win that championship. Maybe the Nets win the championship. Now James Harden's looked at differently. Kyrie's looked at differently. Kevin Durant's looked at differently. So I really think that too many times fans, we live in this ring dominant era, which I do think winning is the ultimate prize that everybody should be after. But I think there's a lot of factors that go into winning. And some of that is out of players' controls, which is why it's so frustrating when fans don't take in the whole context of the situation, you know, and instead of looking at just the player itself.
This is a perfect setup. I was going to go back to your own career and talk about Belmont. But you just said something that was absolutely blasphemous, and that is that LeBron is the second best player of all time. So I need you, Drew, to explain why. I'm assuming you have MJ number one.
Assuming.
Okay. So, okay. Yeah. I mean, I thought you would have had Jokic or something number one. All right. So you have MJ number one. You have LeBron number two. Why MJ over LeBron?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, for me, I grew up obviously an MJ fan, so there is, you know, some bias there. But if you look, he's won two more championships. He's won an additional MVP. He's won, I think, 9 or 10 scoring titles more. He's won a Defensive Player of the Year. He's, you know, it's just, and also just when you look, this is my ultimate take. My ultimate take is if you were in a room full of people and the Bulls and Michael Jordan were down by 15 entering the fourth quarter, and you say, hey, I know he's down by 15. I'll bet $100 that Michael Jordan somehow figures out a way to win this game. I don't think many people would take that bet. And I think that people would still bet on LeBron the same way, but I don't think they'd bet the same way they would on MJ. I think he just has this it factor that separates him, in my opinion. So accolades on paper, obviously, it favors Michael Jordan. And I'm not a longevity guy, because if you are a longevity guy, then you're saying, where does Kareem rank? Because Kareem has just as many championships as Michael Jordan. He has more MVPs, more all-time points, more all-time rebounds, more all-time blocks. Why is he not above, you know, all these other guys? So I'm a big, like, who was the best at their best, you know? And I think that if you look at that peak that Michael Jordan had, it was just unbelievable dominance. You know, the fact that there was a year where he won the scoring title, the regular season MVP, the finals MVP, was also first team all defense. And I think he did that four times and nobody else did it. You know, the fact that there was a year that he won the Olympic gold medal, the finals MVP, the championship, but MVP, like, he just did everything that nobody, he was just so dominant. And he did it on both sides of the ball. And I think that's something that most people don't consider, is how dominant he was defensively as well. That's one thing I hate about this era right now, is no one ever considers the two-way. Two-way. And it's what impact you have on offense and defense. And, you know, I think that, you know, ultimately, if you're just looking at a two-way player that ultimately gets it done, that had the most killer mentality, I think, that we've ever seen in the sport, that's why I'm riding with MJ. But again, I'm not one of those people that says, like, I am going to bash LeBron to prop up MJ. I'm just saying, MJ's here. And LeBron is also way up here. LeBron has had an unbelievable career. I think LeBron has had an underrated career, even as highly rated as he is, because I don't think people realize how hard it is to get to, you know, 10 finals, 8 straight, like dominate a conference where people are literally moving out of your conference because they're like, you can't beat them, you know? So that's my reasoning. And that sounds like you have a different opinion, but that's okay. I respect that. I would just say that if you're looking at on paper their accolades, you're basically saying that LeBron has, MJ has an advantage, the same career that basically Kevin Durant has.
I don't disagree with you, and this is going to sound like a cop out, but so the whole GOAT debate, and we'll end it after this because we could probably spend 3 hours on this. The whole GOAT debate is kind of stupid to me, because nobody has actually defined what it means to be the GOAT. Because if we're talking about like the stat GOAT, right? Like LeBron has that, right? Like most points. I mean, if you look at his rebounds, his assists, the fact that he's averaged 27-7-7 for the last, what is it, 20 years. The stuff that he's done in terms of just pure statistics, I don't think anybody will ever do again. If we're talking about, like, to your point, to your example, you're down 15, who do you trust to bring your team back and win the game? Like, MJ is the choice. like far and away, the mentality, the ability, like all of that stuff. If you're talking about like a regular season GOAT, I would argue like 2012 LeBron with Miami might have been one of the best regular seasons we've ever seen. I mean, he shot what, like 60% from the field, like 40 from three, averaged damn near 30, like just an incredible season. So like, what is it? And then if you're looking at championships, right, then like Bill Russell is the GOAT. So like the definition of...
I don't think you can define it. I think it's all of
right.
That. I think it's all together. And I think that, again, there's a ton of things that matter. LeBron, I mean, LeBron's had, like I said, finals where he's led every stat category and lost. Michael Jordan had a year where he, you know, averaged over 40 points in the playoffs and got swept by the Celtics. Like, so it's, to me, there's a lot more factors, you know, and if you look at, you know, all over the board, it's hard to say anything. And if you say, oh, well, longevity stats matter, then I go, okay, well, is John Stockton the best point guard ever? Because he's the all-time leader in both assists and steals. So that does that mean he's the best, you know, two-way point guard ever? And you're going, no, wait, but he wasn't as good as, well, why? Because you're talking about eye tests, you're talking about MVPs, you're talking about a lot of things. So I don't think that there is a perfect definition for GOAT. I think to me, when I'm explaining it, I'm saying, with my eyes, what have I seen? Who is the greatest basketball player that I've ever witnessed? And from everything that I've seen, from the it factor, from the offensive skill, from the defensive tenacity, you know, from the ultimate, who do I want to shoot the last shot and carry my team? That's why I ultimately choose Michael Jordan. But I have respect for so many other opinions, too, just because I also think that eras change. You know, like if you look back at Kareem, Kareem did not have the film studies, the weightlifting, the, you know, the personal trainers. He didn't have any of that stuff that the modern era has. You know, you look at Michael Jordan, they weren't in a 3-point shooting era. You know, and they also were able to beat him up every time he came through the lane. Like, imagine Michael Jordan without hand checking, you know, and then you go, Michael Jordan didn't start lifting weights until halfway through his NBA career. You know, LeBron probably started lifting weights at 13 years old. So I think there's so many things that you have to take in consideration if you're really thinking about it. And teammates matter. You know, you look at Michael Jordan. The one argument I always use against myself, because I try to just show that I'm a basketball fan, is he arguably had the best rebounder with Dennis Rodman, the best shooter with Steve Kerr percentage-wise, the best defender in Scottie Pippen, the best coach in Phil Jackson. And you're going, and then he had role players like Luke Longley and Tony Kukoc. And like, he had a great team, too. You know, that's part of the reason why they were so good. So I think it's a great basketball conversation. I think very few fans can have the opinion that I have where you can uplift everybody and say, this is why. And I understand the other side of it. You know, I think most people just try to bring people down and instead of lifting everybody up.
Drew, you know how Twitter works. It would be too nice. Like, having rational NBA fans, that's impossible. So, Drew, going back to your own journey, so you chose to go to Belmont University, which I'm sure was an instrumental decision for you. I view it as kind of a turning point in your own career, just listening from other podcasts that you've been on and reading up on you and your journey. It was a turning point in that Belmont was different than other college basketball programs, because in the summers, they essentially gave you the summer off. And what you were able to do with that time really kind of kickstarted, you know, you built off of what you already had in terms of the skills training and the basketball training program. And so I think back, and as I look through your journey, that was like a crossroads where it's like, if you had gone to a Duke or North Carolina, you probably don't have summers off, and, you know, Lord knows what happens with your training program, because now you're just basketball 24/7. And maybe you still end up on the same path that you're on now, but maybe it's 5 years further down the road instead of where you are right now. So all that to say, do you view that in the same light, like that going to Belmont was this turning point in your basketball skills training career?
Yeah, you nailed it. It just gave me the opportunity to continue doing what I was doing in high school. So in high school, I was training all these athletes around St. Louis. When I got to college, I continued that. You know, when I got to college, I also started working with David Lee, who was my first NBA client. I mean, think about it. You know, I'm a junior in high school, or I'm in junior in college. And D. Lee, you know, I'm on a plane with him, traveling around in the offseason, being his trainer, and then coming back and being like, all right, guys, what's up? Like, I'm back playing college mid-major basketball. Like, that experience, it's even hard to think about now looking back. You know, I remember a conversation I had with Steph Curry. We were all at Cheesecake Factory. We were celebrating actually when he signed his 4-year, $44 million deal or whatever the deal he signed was. And so he took us out to Cheesecake Factory that night. And David was like, hey, are you going to go watch Drew like opening night game? And he's like, he's playing against your brother. And he's like, oh, I didn't know you coached, coached college ball. And he's like, no, he plays college ball. He's like, wait, timeout. What do you mean? He's like, I've known Drew for a year. He plays college basketball. Like, first off, I didn't know you were that young. And second, David, what are you doing listening to a mid-major guy as like your trainer, you know? And David said something great. He's like, listen, Phil Jackson cannot beat Michael Jordan or Shaquille O'Neal, you know, in one-on-one. But he can make those guys better versions of himself. And he's like, that's what Drew does to me. He can't beat me in one-on-one. He's not better than me, but he can make me a better version of myself. And that's what I have him for. And so, I wouldn't have had those opportunities if I would have went to a different, college. You know, my coach was big on, we want you to be a regular college student, just like every other student. We want you to make your own decisions in the off season. Hopefully those decisions, are pouring into your basketball game, which I was, still working really hard on my basketball game. But, you also can do other things because we want you to grow as a person, not just a player. And so I'm very fortunate for, Coach Bird allowing us to do those things. And, ultimately led me to, continuing the path that I was on in high school and allowed me to really pour gas on the fire so that I could, exit college with a business and plan.
Building off of that, here's a question for you. I've only asked this once before and it's received good feedback. So we'll give it another shot. If the world was simulated 1,000 times, and how many of those simulations do you think you end up in the exact same spot that you're in now?
Oh, I would say not very many. I think that, you think back of, the career that I had, the first guy that actually paid me for a workout, I was at a 3-court facility. I was on court 3 and his son was playing on court 2. I was working my butt off and I was dripping in sweat. And he came over during the game, tapped me on the shoulder and was like, hey, he's like, I've never seen somebody work that hard. If you can put my son through that exact workout, I'll give you $20. If that moment ever happens, if I decide to skip that workout, if I decide to half-ass that workout, if that player didn't play on that team, if that dad didn't get that frustrated with his watching his son play, all that, then who knows if I would have taken that path. What I do think, though, is I think that out of 1,000 simulations, you would see my relentless work ethic pay off 1,000 out of 1,000 times, because it didn't matter what I chose to do, I was going to figure it out. And so that's why I like the book. Like, I never read books when I was growing up. And now I've published 7 basketball books, and this is my first like self-help book, but that's a new avenue that I am pouring into. The fact of the business stuff. I used to be just a basketball trainer. Now I consult for coaches, and then I started doing keynote speaking, and then I did corporate coaching. And it doesn't matter what I do, I'm going to pour into it. I'm going to figure out ways to make it work. So would I be the a top basketball skills coach in 1,000 out of 1,000 simulations? No chance. In fact, I think there were a lot of things that just worked in my favor, and I was a good product of hard work. And, if you work hard enough and put yourself in as many good situations as possible, usually it pays off. But I do think 1,000 out of 1,000 times my hard work would pay off in whatever I ended up doing.
Love that. Well, in this simulation that we're currently in, you are a top basketball skills coach and you've worked with a very impressive list of clients. I kind of mentioned that at the start, but Jason Tatum, Joel Embiid, Tyrese Maxey, the list of Bradley Beal, which we discussed, the list goes on and on. How do you think that your coaching has evolved as the game has evolved?
A lot. I mean, first off, I've just evolved. I've grown. I've learned more. I've been more efficient in my training practices. I think that if you look at how the game's changed, when I first started, David Lee being my first NBA guy, it was a lot of mid-post isolations. That was back when him and Zach Randolph and Kevin Love was bigger and chunkier and banging down low. And, the Gasol brothers and, like, that was what the NBA was. And now, you know, mid-range has basically been taken out of the game. And, you know, it's a lot more three-point shooting. And, you know, and then we brought back some of the low post dominance with like a Joel Embiid. And, you know, so it's like, to me, it's you're constantly just figuring out solutions for problems out on the court. And, you know, I think that the biggest thing that's evolved for me is, you know, the analytics side of the game is so important. You know, being able to impact winning is so important. And then the other thing is the mindset and the emotional kind of part that I play in my clients' games. You know, at first it was like basketball, and then it was like basketball and hard work. And then it was like, you know, okay, now I got to actually help them with everything. And so, you know, I spend just as much time off the court with my guys as on the court because I think those things go together. You know, I think a lot of NBA players would admit this, but a lot of slumps that occur on the court start off the court. You know, it's amazing how when you look back, a lot of times like fans will be really hard on certain players. And then when they find out what was really going on, the majority of the time they're like, oh. Now, some of them don't care. Some of them are like, it doesn't matter. You need to, you know, compartmentalize that and, you know, still be able to produce. That's what you get paid millions of dollars for. But, like, if I ask the majority of people, like, every day at work, do you crush it? Do you kill it? They'd be like, no, I don't crush it. Some days I have good sales. Some days I have bad. Most of the time I show up and I give halfway effort and I just get through the day. But yet NBA players are expected to be, you know, at this high standard. And so I think that's, you know, that's what I've learned. I've also learned a lot about the NBA. You know, like, for instance, let's say the NBA is 82 games. Most players are going to sit out 10 games, whether it's injury, load management, whatever. Let's say they play 72 games, and that's a good, healthy season. 10 of those games, they're going to be amazing. 10 of the games, they are going to be awful. And then 52 of the games are going to be eh. But fans can't comprehend that. Fans cannot comprehend that most games are just going to be eh. That's their average. You know, their average game is what they are. They're only going to have 10 wow games. They're going to have 10 whoa games. The rest is just average. And so I've just learned a lot about how to help manage emotions, help manage confidence, and pour into players outside of just straight skill development, which I think is very important.
That's a fantastic point. Which is bad on me as a fan, but I recently found out because I was reading another book, Tanking to the Top by Yaron Weitzman, another fantastic book, writes about the Sixers process and their whole rebuilding with Sam Hinkie. I didn't realize that in Joel Embiid's rookie year, his brother died, and he died tragically. I think he got hit by a bus or something along those lines. And it like really puts it into perspective. Anytime a tragedy occurs outside of a player's life, or outside of the basketball court, it puts everything into perspective in terms of, at the end of the day, this is a game, right? You're getting paid millions to play a game that you love, but there are other things in life that are way more important, such as the life of your brother. And I just think back to even like Joel's rookie year, like the amount of Sixers fans that were bashing on him for, you know, he was obviously hurt and, you know, just, oh, this guy, like, I, you know, this guy might suck, whatever. And like, meanwhile, he's like trying to figure out how to deal with like one of life's biggest tragedies. Like that dichotomy really really struck me.
I mean, again, that is an amplified way, but it is. I mean, I look at everything from, you know, Joel, when he came to this country, didn't speak English. You know, he didn't touch a basketball till he was 16 years old. And then, you know, now you look a decade later, he's the leading scorer of the league and won an MVP, and he has battled through so many injuries. You know, I think there's been one offseason that he hasn't had a surgery in his entire career. And you're like, hold up, you know, from going from 16 to not touching a basketball to becoming, you know, arguably the greatest player in the NBA to being a scoring champion to being an MVP, despite all of the BS that went on in the front office, despite all the injuries that he's had to get through, it just shows you how much, you know, hard work, how much he's poured, how much he's grown, how much he's improved, you know. And even if you look at like Kansas, you know, because some guys might say, oh, he was still a top pick. Like at Kansas, he averaged 11 points a game. He made one three-pointer in his career at Kansas, and he was shooting 66% from the free throw line. For him to, you know, go on to being a guy that last year averaged 35, 12, and 6. Like, think about that. If he had a game where he had 35 points, 11 rebounds, and 5 assists, his averages dropped. Like, that's how good he was last year, and that's how good he is when he's healthy. It's just, to me, that's what I wish there was more light shined on. You know, there's other examples of people that, whether they're dealing with, you know, they're missing the births of their child, or, you know, or the deaths of their family members, or, you know, there's other, you know, circumstances or situations that we don't even know about. I mean, that happens a lot. You know, in the starting five doc, it was really cool to see Jimmy Butler open about, you know, the you know, his situation that he was going through and dealing with. And most fans didn't care about that. You know, all they cared about was their parlay or their fantasy team, instead of like the bigger than basketball picture that we should be focusing on. And so I really do think that, you know, when people talk about the NBA ratings, I think the product on the court is improving. You know, guys are more skilled. They're better shot makers. They're, you know, the schemes and systems are at a all time, you know, complexity levels at all time high. What's changed is the fans. You know, it's a ring culture. So now everybody, all they care about is, did you win or did you not? Well, that means obviously that the regular season is going to feel less important because everyone's making it less important. You know, people don't care about individual matchups anymore. Some guys do. Like, it was really fun last night watching Wemby and Giannis, and you saw, you know, Giannis taking the defensive side personal. You see, I know you joked around about Jokic and Joel. You know what happens every time they play against each other. So it's, to me, if we want basketball ratings to go back up, or we need to start, one, caring more about the people and not just the player. Two, we got to start telling stories instead of just hot takes and quick clickbait. And then three, we got to have more positivity, you know, and shining light on all the great things that basketball has to offer, and all the stories that these guys have ever overcome, you know, and all the great moments that we all get to experience as fans because these guys are super talented. You know, think about all the highs. I know there are some lows as fans, but think about all the highs that, you know, I remember when I was growing up watching, you know, Michael Jordan and Allen Iverson, and, you know, even guys like Hot Sauce. I remember N1 Mixtape brought me joy. Like, I wish we got back to that. To me, that is what, you know, and it's funny because the Jokic takes, you know, a lot of people thought like, oh, he's the biggest Jokic hater. I'm like, you guys don't realize I love watching Jokic play. I think he's one of the most talented basketball players that have ever played the game. I think that his feel and his touch are unmatched. You know, I really do. And people are like, wait, but you say, I said, no. I highlight some of the areas of defense that I think aren't as strong because I'm also trying to prop my guy up. And, you know, and sometimes I like to compare and contrast, and I'm like, well, we got to look at the whole picture, but no, I respect the hell out of his game, you know? And it's funny, every time you hear conversations about from Joel or from Jokic, they're both like, we love each other. We respect each other. We appreciate each other. And that's why they love competing against each other, because they do know that they're both at the top of the game. So I think that's what the NBA needs more of, is more celebrating. You know, back when we were growing up, we used to turn on Stuart Scott and watch SportsCenter and watch, you know, the highlights and him. Then after that, there would be like a story about, you know, a 3 minute to 6 minute segment about, you know, what are these guys overcoming some kind of crazy upbringing to make it. It's like, that is what is the good thing is about basketball. And so that's what I hope we get back to at some point, instead of just hot takes and clickbait and just, you know, engaging in this or that, instead of let's prop everybody up.
You're preaching to the choir, Drew. I mean, that's honestly what I try to do with this podcast, is whenever I have an athlete on, you know, we had Josh Dobbs on the podcast, and it's like, hey, man, like, tell me, you know, you're an aerospace engineer at Tennessee. Like, what was that like? Like, what was that? Or how, you know, what was your upbringing like? How were your parents like really supportive? Like, what was football something you always wanted to do? I almost feel like there is a, I don't know what the word is for what the word would be for this, but like, there, I feel like most fans almost don't even view NBA players as like humans anymore. Like, I don't know if I don't know if that's like sports betting, where it's like you're watching a game and all you see is like dollar signs and like your parlay and like, you know, oh, Joel Embiid needs three more rebounds, you know, for my parlay to hit. The fact that, you know, he's dealing with off the court drama, that doesn't matter. Really, he just needs to get these three rebounds so that my, you know, plus 150 parlay can hit and I can make $35. So like, I don't know how much you can say about sports betting and the impact that it's had on the game. My personal opinion is that it has been terrible, and I don't know what the solution is, because I think we as a society seemingly are gravitating towards more and more betting and gamifying literally everything. So like, I don't know if it's reversible. I just think in terms of the impact that's had on the game, that it has been I can't say 100% negative because there is some, you know, fun aspects to it here and there, but it has been an overwhelming negative impact on the game of basketball.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, obviously, I think sports betting, if you're betting a responsible number that doesn't impact your life at all, it can add joy and fun and, like, you know, that feeling of like, oh, wow, the possibilities. It can also, if you don't care about a game, it can make you care a little bit about a game. Like if you're watching two teams that you don't, you know, have any particular interest for. But when you're betting things that, you know, you're, when you're relying on those bets to hit, that's when you see that negativity, that, you know, that that negative energy that, like what you said, where they just stop caring about them as people and they really, all they care about is winning that bet. And so I think there's good and bad with everything. You know, I think that obviously the game is growing financially and that benefits all the players. But when you see some of these fans, them yelling some of the comments that they yell to these players, you're like, you would never say that in the real world. You just know you're protected because they can't leave the court and come kick your ass. But, like, you know, I love Joe Mazzulla, and I love all of his crazy, you know, mindset and stuff like that. But, you know, he had a take earlier this season where he said, I wish everybody walked around with five tokens. And every year you got five tokens. And if you wanted to fight somebody, you could redeem one of your tokens five times a year. And you got to spar with that person. And I was like, man, can you imagine? Some of these fans would shut up real quick if they had to say what they're saying to that person's face. And if they actually got to know the players, you know, they would actually realize all these guys are great guys, you know. And again, just like the world, there's good and bad people and there's better and, you know, better people and stuff like that. But I think that really when you dig deep, you know, these NBA players, they're all on a journey just like all of us. They all have highs and lows just like all of us. They just happen to be really, really talented in the thing they do. And we all appreciate it, and that's why we go to watch the games, because we're celebrating all the success that they've been able to acquire through a ton of hard work, a ton of sacrifices. So I think that's the biggest thing, is just being able to get back to uplifting the game.
Drew, I want to ask you a couple questions about some of the client work that you do. I want to start here. I recently read a fantastic article on ESPN on Steph Curry talking about his performance anxiety that he gets before games. Someone who has watched Steph Curry his entire career, I would never have guessed that he, out of all people, has performance anxiety before games and that he gets nervous. Like, never would have clicked. What are some things that most fans, through your work, through knowing these players personally, we've touched on a couple things already, but some things that most fans don't realize about NBA players?
One, that they're great people. Two, that they struggle and stress just like all the rest of us. Three, that their confidence goes up and down just like the rest of us. I mean, that they're not unbreakable. They're not machines. They're just like all of us. I think that's the biggest thing that people don't realize, is like, they're not special. You know, they just happen to be really, really good at something that we, you know, enjoy watching. So I think that would be the biggest thing that I would start with, is just, they just happen to be really, really good at something, but that doesn't, you know, kind of segment them away from being a normal human being.
We'll do these next ones kind of rapid fire as we wrap up the pod. And then I want to end actually talking about your book a little bit. So we'll end on that note. Is there a favorite? You've, again, worked with a ton of clients. Is there a favorite transformation that you have been a part of? I know there's some Tatum stories in there. There's an Embiid story. There's a Haliburton story, which, by the way, I'm a Kings fan. I am still sad that we traded away Haliburton. But has there been a couple of favorite transformations that you've been a part of for some of these guys?
Man, I mean, there's so many that come to mind, you know, and I don't know if there's one that stands out to me, to be honest with you. Like, you know, you look at Joel going from the 11 points a game at Kansas to leading scorer of the NBA multiple seasons and MVP. That's really awesome. You know, Jason, I've been with since he was 13. Brad, I've been with since he was 13. So those guys, I feel such a part of their development. Like I always say, like, they're the ones that deserve all the credit, but I've just been there for so long and you know, taking the step-by-step, you know, kind of route with them, that those ones I feel more connected with. You know, seeing Haliburton go from 12 and a half points a game to an all-star starter in the first year that we worked together, seeing Maxey win most improved player the first year we worked together. You know, it's just like, you know, even now, like this year, Trey Murphy, like you see his jump that he's going on right now, averaging 21 a game that no one thought was going to happen. So to me, it's again, it's all about, you know, can you raise a guy's level one or two levels? And I think that's what I try to pride myself in doing for every guy that I work with. And again, not everyone's going to be a home run. Some guys are going to be singles. Some guys are going to be doubles. But, you know, what you try to do as a trainer is you try to pour into everybody, give them as many solutions or as problems that they have. And hopefully the results, you know, they come.
I loved your, I think you talked about it on Rachel DeMita's podcast, maybe like 2 years ago. The story with Halliburton, how he wasn't being aggressive enough. And then you photoshopped, what was it, like the number, it was like 14 shots, like you need to be taking 14 shots per game or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's great. I literally, it was funny because I gave him a copy of the book the other day, and the first thing he did was opened it up and he read it. He read it before the Sixers game, which was ironic because a couple years ago, he's playing for the Kings, and you know, his agent reached out to me and said, hey, I really need you because he's going to be on a contract here next year. And we think that, you know, him averaging 12 points a game is not going to, you know, be great. You know, we think 12 points a game is he's probably going to make like $80 million, I think was the number that they said, like 4 years, $80 million, $20 million a year. And they're like, we know that, you know, you've improved a lot of guys' scoring and mentalities. Can you help them out? And so I took him out to dinner and I roasted him. I mean, I was just going off on him. Well, you know, who's this guy better than you? Is this guy better than you? Well, you know, this, you're this many shots per game and this. And I did all the analytics and everything. And he's like, well, I want to work with you, bro. Let's work this summer. And I said, well, if you want to work with me, you got to shoot 14 shots tomorrow night against the Sixers. And he was like, what? And I was like, 14 FGAs. I go, I don't care if you go for 14 or 14 for 14. I just want to see that you're willing to try something new. Get out of your comfort zone a little bit. And at the time, he's averaging 12 and a half points a game, and he scored 38 points that night, career high. He went 11 for 19 from the field. And I remember George Niang had his arm around him walking around the corner because George played for the Sixers at the time and both being, you know, Iowa State guys. And he said, Drew, he told me he took you out on a date last night and he had his career high. He goes, if that's all it takes, I'd love to take you on a date. And we were just dying laughing, you know, but that's a great story. I go into details about it in the book. But like then the other day we're in Philadelphia, I hand him the book. He reads that story again. I go, read it again. Because, you know, he needed another boost this season. And sure enough, he goes off for, I think he had 33 points or something. And everyone was like, is it that easy? I'm like, well, obviously it takes a lot of trust building and stuff like that. But that's what it is. It's sometimes it's pushing guys mentally just as much as you're pushing them on the skill side and the physical side.
Yeah, I love that story. It's a fantastic story. Again, like I said, still sad that the Kings traded him. But let's talk about the book. Book comes out February 11th, I believe, much anticipated. The book is called Stop Bullshitting Yourself. Why write the book and why now?
I mean, to be honest with you, the first reason I wrote the book is because I was copy and pasting over and over again different messages to all my players, and I was helping them out because, you know, anytime that it worked for somebody, then I share it to somebody else. And I had all these treasures of these stories that had been untold, and it helped with all my guys' mentalities. It helped with their confidence. It helped with the strategies. And then I get constantly asked, like, how do you help these guys always improve their game? And so I have this system that I use, and then I use that same system to help my dad lose 90 pounds. And I use that same system to help, you know, a couple of CEOs, you know, increase their profits on the business world. And so I was like, it's time to actually like share these stories, you know, help people improve their mentalities, help people improve their confidence, help people tackle the things that they know they need to tackle to improve their lives, and then give them the system for success that allows, you know, them to really break down that one big audacious goal into bite-sized pieces so that they can finally follow through with action and get the results they've always wanted. And so, I mean, it took me 3 years. You know, and it was crazy going through all the stories where I'm like, oh my God, this story, oh my God, this story. And, you know, I'm super excited. I've given the copy to a couple of my clients, and, you know, it was funny. I asked for a testimonial from a lot of the guys, and Zach Levine started with the testimonial. I never read books. I hate books, but I couldn't put this one down. I was like, that's a great testimonial, you know, and you know, a lot of my guys have shared that same thing. Everything is bite-sized. So every section's like 1 to 2 pages so people can pick it up and put it down. And then it also has a workbook in it so you can fill out, you know, basically all the different prompts throughout the book so that when you leave, you know, reading the book, you actually have a blueprint to tackle whatever you want to tackle.
And if you go and order the book right now, and if you head over to drewhanlon.com, put in your receipt and some other information, you get some extra goodies that help on with your own self-improvement journey. I've done it. I highly suggest the frameworks that you outline. If you pre-order the book, highly suggest people go and do that. DrewHanlon.com and then Drew Hanlon on all social media. You can find the links there, and the links, of course, will be in the show notes of this episode as well. Drew, what's next, man? As we wrap up this episode, you're working with some of the, I mean, the best NBA athlete, you know, former champions, and Jason Tatum, former MVP, and with Embiid, you know, the Tyler Heroes of the world, who's having a great season too, might I add. You're working with some of the top NBA guys. You got a book coming out. I mean, you're on top of the world. What's next for Drew Hanlon?
Just keep going. I've never been a guy that's had a 5-year, 10-year plan. I've always just basically said, like, take the step that you need to today. And so that's what I'm doing. You know, I'm going to take the step today and take the step tomorrow. And, you know, eventually I'll love the path that I go on. But, you know, I'm big on internal peace. And I think that most people chase this external success and think they're going to reach a milestone that's going to ultimately, you know, solve all their problems and make them feel like all this joy. But I don't believe that exists. And, you know, I think that for me, it's all about, you know, constantly, you know, being the best version of yourself, also helping other people reach the best versions of their self. And then, you know, ultimately all of us experiencing success on and off the court. And so that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to keep pouring into players, pouring into coaches, pouring into everyday people. That's why I did the book. So there wasn't just athletes and coaches that got to benefit from the systems and strategies. But that's what I think you'll see more of. I think you'll see more of me pouring into the you know, personal growth category so that, you know, everybody can benefit from, you know, the same exact tactics and strategies that help the most successful entrepreneurs and athletes. You know, it helps everyday moms and dads as well.
Love it. Drew, I would be doing a disservice to my audience if I didn't ask you one last question, then I promise we'll let you go. We won't hold you captive any longer. I teased your golf game with MJ. I believe Tatum was there too. As someone who grew up, you know, idolizing MJ, what was that experience like? And did you take away anything from your interactions with MJ?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, one of the coolest days of my life. There are very few moments where I have like pinch me moments, and everyone always is like, Drew, realize you like train like the majority of the best players in the NBA and this and that. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't think back about that stuff. You know, I do think it's cool when I get to bring my nieces and nephews and they're sitting courtside at games and their favorite players are dapping them up and they're calling them Uncle Jason or Uncle Joel. Like, that's cool to me. Like, you know, but the truth is, you know, the MJ day was a pinch me moment just because I grew up like idolizing him, watching every game. And, you know, I had introduced, you know, a bunch of players to a bunch of other players, but I had never met MJ. And so I remember when Jason and I worked with Kobe, that was like Jason's bucket list moment. You know, it was like, hey, we worked with Kobe, check it off. And then I was like, you know who's next? We got to get MJ. And when he signed with Jordan Brand, you know, he obviously built a friendship with MJ. And, you know, I remember, you know, Jason got invited to play golf and, you know, asked if he could bring me with him. And I got to go down there and we played, you know, around at the Grove. And then, you know, there's a rain delay. So we got to, Jason was like, man, it's raining. I was like, good. We get to hang out in the clubhouse and I get to pick his brain. So I just got to ask a lot of great questions that I had always wondered all my life. And, you know, I'm keeping most of that private just because I want to respect him. But I'd put it this way, the 10-year-old, you know, 8-year-old version of me was smiling the entire day. And it was a really cool moment that, you know, I appreciate Jason for allowing me to be a part of it.
Love it. Stop Bullshitting Yourself is the book. February 11th is the release date. I highly encourage everybody who's listening to this to go pick up and pre-order the book to get those extra goodies that we mentioned that you can find at drewhanlon.com. Drew Hanlon on all social media. Drew, anything else you want to plug?
That is it, man. I appreciate you having me on. I enjoyed talking with you.
Absolutely. The pleasure is all mine. Thanks so much for your time.
Appreciate you.